From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I would say that we were the most law-abiding people during that period. So this is why the FBI had to resort to all these lies and techniques to trick us, because...
Will Geronimo Pratt be released? We'll speak with his lawyer, Stuart Hanlon. Also, our vanishing privacy, what you can do to protect yours, an activist push for democratic reform of the United Nations. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Betty Shabazz underwent a fourth operation yesterday to remove and replace burned skin tissue. The widow of Malcolm X remains in critical condition from burns suffered a week ago in a fire at her apartment. The hospital says 72% of Shabazz's burned tissue has been removed and that her next operation is scheduled for tomorrow. Today in New York, a blood drive has started for her in Harlem. Federal officials investigating three bombings in Atlanta were expected to ask the general public today to help track down a group that has claimed responsibility for two of the attacks. The FBI, the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and state investigators scheduled a high-profile news conference in Atlanta hotel, where officials say they will release excerpts from two copies of a letter purported to be from a violent anti-abortion group called the Army of God. Federal agents hope members of the public will recognize the author's wording or handwriting, just as the Unabomber's published manuscript led to the arrest of suspect Theodore Kaczynski in 1996. There's no national conspiracy to torch churches, but still many remain under attack. That's the conclusion of a special task force President Clinton formed a year ago after a series of fires at predominantly black churches in the South. The report is being released as ministers whose churches were burned gather in Washington for a three-day conference. Later in the week, we'll get their reaction. This news from New Hampshire. It has banned discrimination because of sexual orientation and job hiring, this housing decisions, and public accommodations. New Hampshire becomes the 11th state to offer civil rights protection to gays and lesbians. The bill, signed into law on Friday by Governor Jean Shaheen, takes effect on January 1st. A similar measure failed 3 years ago after strong opposition from the Catholic Church. Teamsters President Ron Carey faces calls for his ouster after Friday's arrest of a campaign fundraiser who helped him win re-election last year. The union said his officers were cooperating with officials investigating allegations that the Carey campaign accepted illegal funds to help defeat challenger Jimmy Hoffa. Air Force General Ralston isn't expected to remain a candidate for Joint Chiefs chair. The Air Force General cut short a trip to Asia and returned to Washington amid expectations that he would be dropped from consideration for the top military post because of an adulterous relationship in his past. It appears unlikely he even will be nominated by President Clinton. In fact, officials predicted that Ralston will end his 32-year career in the military when his term as vice chair of the Joint Chiefs expires in several months. In this international news, a senior Turkish military official publicly contradicted the country's prime minister yesterday, insisting that a three-week offensive against Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq was continuing. The Turkish prime minister had earlier told reporters the operation had come to an end. And in other international news, Irish Prime Minister Bruton has conceded defeat in elections that were held on Friday. His narrow loss means that Fianna Fáil leader Bertie Ahern, who has vowed to bring peace to Northern Ireland, will likely be chosen to head a new coalition. The election ended Bruton's 30-month-old government, which presided over an economic boon. Sierra Leone's defense chief warned that his forces were too weak to challenge Nigerian troops seeking to reverse a military coup, and he urged negotiations to avert renewed violence. Nigerian troops are widely expected to launch another military strike after their unsuccessful attempt last week to restore civilian President Kabah. And Congo's new government may receive military cooperation from the U.S. as an incentive to adhere to human rights standards. This according to U.S. Envoy Bill Richardson. He said this in Kinshasa. President Kabila met with Richardson over the weekend and agreed to allow U.N. officials to freely investigate the alleged massacre of refugees. and you're listening to Democracy Now! Today we're going to start the show by talking about Geronimo Pratt. Los Angeles District Attorney Gil Garcetti announced Friday that he will appeal the reversal of former Black Panther Party leader Geronimo Pratt's 1972 murder conviction. Garcetti said he found no evidence indicating the former Black Panther Party leader was innocent. Pratt's conviction was overturned a little over a week ago after new proof that the chief witness against him was a police and FBI informant who lied under oath. Orange County Superior Court Judge Everett Dickey ordered Pratt released from prison to the Los Angeles County Sheriff and said authorities should give him a new trial or drop the case. Despite the Los Angeles District Attorney's decision to appeal the ruling, Garcetti did announce he will not oppose bail because of the unusual circumstances of Pratt's case and the fact that he's been incarcerated for 27 years. A bail hearing for Geronimo Pratt is now set for Tuesday. Joining us today from San Francisco is one of Geronimo's attorneys, Stuart Hanlon. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Stuart.
Hi.
Well, why don't you tell us your reaction to Garcetti's announcement on Friday that he's going to appeal the reversal of Geronimo Pratt's conviction?
Well, I think all of us expected him to make the decision that he made. I think he's, at this point, because of politics, incapable of making the right decision. We appreciate he's not opposing bail, but I think the judge would have given us bail anyway, so that we haven't gotten help from the district attorney's office in the whole 25-year saga, so we really didn't expect to get it now, and we are confident that Tuesday Geronimo will get out on bail and that we will proceed and win the appeal, and if he decides to retry it, win the trial. I mean, I think this was what we expected from the day we got the decision Geronimo's trial would be reversed.
Now, although you and Johnny Cochran have said that you're outraged by Gil Garcetti saying that he would seek an appeal, that he was going to appeal the reversal, in a way, is this a kind of settlement that Geronimo Pratt gets out tomorrow and then this appeal process goes on, but he's still out?
Well, it's a one-sided settlement. We're not negotiating. I think Mr. Garcetti's trying to reach a politically acceptable decision that will appeal to everybody, when in one sense it appeals to nobody. He's bargaining against himself. I mean, I don't know how else to explain it. Our outrage was really not so much at the appeal. It's what he put in his press statement, that he felt that the prosecutors on the case for the last 27 years have all acted ethically and appropriately, and his feeling that he still believes there's no evidence Geronimo was innocent. I think he didn't have to make those kind of statements, and that's what caused the reaction on Friday. But the decision itself, you know, we'll live with any decision he makes.
I'm looking at an AP report that talks about Gil Garcetti's announcement Friday, saying that his office had discovered new evidence relating to the credibility of the witness. He would not discuss the specifics of the case. Can you explain what that is about?
Well, I think what he's referring to is that his office uncovered what it had for 27 years and never turned over before. The fact that his office itself considered Butler an informant and had an informant card on him, and that one of his officers had paid the Butler $200 to buy a gun prior to the trial. Those facts certainly helped us. But he tries to segregate credibility of the witness versus actual innocence. And it's very difficult for someone to prove they're innocent when the government has all the evidence. How do you prove you weren't at a murder? The evidence that's been uncovered, including that and all the other evidence, I think is very strong evidence that Geronimo's innocent. And Garcetti's trying to box it into an area of the public perceived as a technicality, which simply isn't true.
We're talking to Stuart Hanlon, who is longtime attorney for Geronimo Pratt. In fact, when did you start representing Geronimo?
In 1974, when I was in law school in San Francisco.
That's, what, 23 years ago. How did you get involved with the case?
I was introduced to him. Well, I began law school for what I considered very overt political reasons and wanted to work with groups like the Panthers and other people who were being prosecuted and persecuted by the government. And Geronimo was moved to San Quentin, and I was going to law school in San Francisco, which is really close to San Quentin. And I was doing work in prisons, and he and I met and we started talking about his case. And after knowing him, I immediately believed he, in fact, was innocent. And as we uncovered the facts of his case, it became clear that he had been framed for something he didn't do. And we had the same agenda, which was getting him out and understanding what the government had done. So it just took a little longer than we had planned. We really didn't plan it to last 23 years.
So let's talk about what exactly this appeal will mean. Geronimo Pratt gets out tomorrow, and then where does the appeal go?
The appeal goes to one of these appellate courts in the state of California where it's briefed. You know, people write legal arguments, and it goes back and forth for about a year. What you said before, it's a compromise by Garcetti with himself. I mean, the case, I think, will die in the appellate court. Once Geronimo's out on bail, he's been in for 27 years, the case really has reached a conclusion. And I think what Mr. Garcetti hopes that it will just slowly die in the Court of Appeals, and he'll lose the appeal with Garcetti, and then he'll just say, well, we lost the appeal and we're not going to retry it. It really is something, just a slow way to end it outside the public's view. I mean, I think that's what he wants.
I'm looking at a piece that was written in the Los Angeles Times by Bill Boyarsky last Thursday about why Pratt case, this is the headline, why Pratt case didn't grab more attention. And he compares it to, for example, the O.J. Simpson case, in which Johnny Cochran is also the attorney. But it says the explanation is found in history and the attitudes of the black community and the mainstream media toward the revolutionary organization that Pratt helped lead, the Black Panther Party, and toward the powerful, often undisciplined, sometimes lawless protests that were sweeping through the United States in the 60s and 70s. What's your response to that?
Well, I read that article, and I, you know, at the time I read it, I was a bit, I disagree with some of it. I mean, obviously, news is what you guys in the media make it in many ways. I mean, some stories can't be controlled, but most cases are only news if the media covers them. And for a long time, we had very little coverage of the Geronimo Pratt case, the history through the courts. I think, you know, the Panthers did alienate some members of the black community, but it also was embraced by some members of the black community. So I don't know if there's an easy answer why it took us so long. I think the real answer is that, or another answer is that, after the late 60s and 70s, we started the era of Nixon, Reagan, Bush politics and the public's view of, you know, let's get hard on criminals, we don't want political dissent. You know, we had this whole change in our country in the view of people towards our government and how we saw crime and issues like that. And I think that had a lot to do with, historically, why this case wasn't covered or didn't get a lot of public interest, because the period of time that we went through in the last 25 years, probably more so than, I think, Mr. Boyarsky's view that the black community rejected the Black Panther Party. But some of that, you know, some of that's true.
You know, I should say, give a little more background on the case. This weekend I was in Chicago for the public radio conference, and I mentioned Geronimo's case to a number of news directors and general managers of public radio stations, because I was saying what we're going to be doing today on Democracy Now! And every single one of them, you know, Geronimo, maybe they had a faint glimmer of recognition, but they almost knew nothing about the case. Pratt was convicted in 72 of murdering teacher Carolyn Olson, critically wounding her husband during a 68 robbery on a Santa Monica tennis court. Pratt's always said he was in Oakland when the crime occurred and that the FBI knew he was innocent because the Bureau had him under surveillance. In fact, isn't it true that Carolyn Olson's husband, who was critically injured, actually identified someone else before he fingered Geronimo, but that was never raised in the trial?
Right. The identification of Geronimo took place 2 years after the shooting based on a photo spread where the Julio Butler instigated. And his, Mr. Olson identified somebody else as the killer a year earlier, and that evidence was suppressed by the prosecution. That was another key piece of evidence that Judge Dickey pointed to. There's a whole lot of things like that in Geronimo's case. I mean, wiretaps that were hidden that we haven't even litigated or lost that would have shown Geronimo in Oakland. The fact that the FBI had spies put in Cochran's defense team back in 1972, which really is unheard of in our judicial system, government agencies spying on a defense team.
What do you mean, had spies put in?
Well, they had informants or spies working in his office, and we've never discovered who they were. It's just the FBI announced in 1980 that they, in fact, did have spies in his office. And at that point, he wasn't the famous Johnny Cochran. I mean, he was just a defense lawyer defending Pratt. And they fed information back to the FBI and about the defense strategy, especially about meetings with Kathleen Cleaver, who flew in from Algeria to be a witness. And, I mean, it's really unheard of in our legal system where the government puts spies in the lawyer's office to get information. But we never could get a reversal on that because I think, you know, historically the political climate of the judiciary stopped us from winning. People really don't see the court system as political. They tend to see it as, oh, it's independent. But I think a lot of judges are political. I think we have a group that are political hacks, you know, on some level. That's what they get appointed in. Politics play a big part of the legal system. I mean, if you practice here in the legal system all the time, you understand that. And we just had a really difficult time getting a fair hearing. But I think people, you know, why would the government put a spy in a lawyer's office but to find out confidential information? Otherwise, you wouldn't do it.
Tell us what your visit was like to the Mule Creek State Prison last week for your first face-to-face visit with Geronimo Pratt since the murder conviction was overturned. You went there with Johnny Cochran.
Right. Well, it started out very funny because Cochran was flying in from Sacramento when we each had car phones and were trying to give him directions as we drove from different areas. So it was a really kind of funny meeting to begin with. And then when we got to see Geronimo, it was normally when you go to prison, especially to see him over the years, is a kind of quiet and sometimes open hostility by a lot of the guards. Just the visits take forever to get in. Everything's kind of difficult. And we came, and there were guards waiting to, you know, to meet us, and they shook our hands, and some of them hugged us and congratulated us. And it was a really almost a party atmosphere, very friendly. And then we went into the visiting room. It was not a visiting day, so it was just Geronimo and us, and the four or five guards came just to kind of hang out, and they congratulated G. They obviously knew him. They talked to us about the case. They knew about the case. A lot of them were Vietnam vets and talked about their commonality with G on that issue, and they all wished him well. And it was amazing. I mean, this is really unheard of in the prison setting. I mean, normally the defense lawyers are seen as enemies to prison officials and guards, and we're the bad guys and girls, It was great. It was really a really positive, almost uplifting experience. Plus, Geronimo was in an incredibly good frame of mind and talked about his plans and was really happy. I mean, this is a man who, though he doesn't really get angry, I mean, he's been under incredible stress for a number of years, and most of these meetings we've had after court hearings have been depressing.
So Geronimo Pratt is in jail right now in Orange County, no longer at Mule Creek State Prison?
Right. He's been discharged from prison. That was really an exciting day when he called up last week and said, I'm discharged. I mean, normally you go to court and you get out the court papers, but he was discharged. So he's out of prison custody, and he's in county jail. We're all going down there today and meeting with him, and we hope to walk him out of county jail tomorrow.
What time is the hearing tomorrow?
The hearing's at 10.
California time.
Right.
Well, we couldn't get in touch directly with Geronimo, but we do have a tape of his that was done years ago as he described what it was like to be in solitary confinement. This is Geronimo Pratt. We're speaking with Geronimo Pratt's attorney, Stuart Hanlon.
During those 8 years, each seemed like each year they would, the prison administration would have to come up with some pretext to justify maintaining me in that status, in that whole status. Throughout those years, I was accused of everything from child kidnapping, holding people hostage, assaulting prison staff. I mean, all kind of hideous kind of crimes that you could think of. I want these things aired out in open court. They're not true. I was accused of being a member of prison gangs, which has never been true. I've been accused of a lot of things that's not true. Also, most fundamental to all of this.
Geronimo Pratt describing some of his time in prison. Stuart Hanlon, we want to thank you very much for joining us, and we hope to be speaking with Geronimo Pratt live later this week.
Right, I think that's going to be a success. successful hope. And thanks for having me on.
Thanks very much, Stuart Hanlon, Geronimo Pratt's attorney for more than 23 years. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about our vanishing privacy. Stay with us on this Pacifica Radio National News Magazine. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. A survey released on the eve of important government hearings on web privacy suggests computer users are extremely vulnerable to cyberspace spying and other personal intrusions by internet businesses. The results could help frame one of the most fundamental debates in the evolution of the internet as a commercial marketplace, whether the industry can police itself or the governments must step in to protect millions of personal computer users. Starting tomorrow, the Federal Trade Commission will hold unusually broad hearings in response to complaints by privacy advocates that personal information is gathered and used by online operators without user consent or knowledge. The Electronic Privacy Information Center, known as EPIC, a nonprofit consumer group participating in the talks, released its survey in a preemptive volley ahead of the Washington hearings. Well, the explosive growth in the use of electronic information in recent years has spawned a huge and many say frightening new industry that tracks and sells personal information on millions of Americans. From health and financial data to what we eat or watch on television, many of our day-to-day activities are now being recorded and stored on a computer somewhere with serious implications for privacy rights. Joining us today to talk about the information collection industry, the growing threat to privacy, and how we can protect ourselves is Robert Ellis Smith. He's the publisher of The Privacy Journal, an independent monthly newsletter on privacy in the computer age. He's also a lawyer and author of the recently published book, Our Vanishing Privacy and What You Can Do to Protect Yours. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Robert Smith.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, I don't want to focus as much on the internet as on things that really everyone is involved with. For example, credit card use, the use of phones and how they can be monitored. Can you talk about what you think the greatest threats to our privacy are right now?
Well, some things never change. I think the inaccuracy of credit reports is still a problem, causing lots of problems for people. I think also the release of certain identifying information in a credit report by credit bureaus to marketers causes real problems. It creates, I think, opportunities for stalkers. That's the information that identifies people at the top of a credit report, like their name and address, but also their phone number, whether or not it's listed, mother's maiden name, and especially Social Security numbers. That information can be released by credit bureaus, and that's what creates a lot of these data banks on the internet and elsewhere that provide identifying information on individuals, allow stalkers, ex-spouses, anybody else to get that information. That kind of flow of information has caused real problems for people. We're seeing more problems, as Newt Gingrich can testify, to some of the new technologies involving telephone monitoring. People don't realize what the consequences are of using either a cellular phone or a cordless telephone. Those are not very secure mediums. So those are the issues that concern us right now.
I want to go back to the whole idea of header information on credit reports and how people are getting a hold of it. You mean, can you just explain that further?
Well, the information that identifies people and that is so-called above the line on a credit report may be sold and bought by credit bureaus without any protections of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which protects the information in the credit report itself. This information then is sold by information brokers, or it becomes part of mailing lists. There is software now on the internet that can take a phone number and match it to an address, or vice versa. And most of this information comes from that header information in a credit report. People really think that they're getting something for having unlisted phone service. And by the way, anywhere from 20 to 35% of people in major cities are unlisted now. But unlisted protection is really a thing of the past, because when you provide your phone number for credit purposes, that information goes to the credit bureau. And now the government has ruled that a credit bureau may sell that information freely.
Let's talk about the Social Security number. We have, I think, in this country, a natural aversion to the idea of a national ID card. But in a sense, hasn't the Social Security number become that?
In bits and pieces, yes, I'm afraid it has. And politicians sense this natural aversion that we have, which I think is correct. We remember the Nazi experience, and we've all seen old B movies where the Gestapo gets on the train and says, "Are your papers in order?" And Americans really shy away from that. They don't want any part of that. But politicians sense this, and bureaucrats as well, and they implement their little steps towards that incrementally without any consideration for the cumulative effect. The Social Security number, even though it's a very poor identifier, is now demanded in more and more situations, as we know, that go far beyond pensions and tax identification. And Congress disastrously, I think, last summer, passed a lot of new legislation that's going to really make it a national ID card. One is that they passed a law that will require a national ID number for anybody to get health care anywhere in the nation, even if they're paying for it themselves, even if the person getting the health care is a minor. And that number most likely will be the Social Security number. And with the knowledge of probably three people in the United States, Congress now made it a law that states really have to display the Social Security number on the outside of a driver's license. That is effective in the year 2000, and I think there's still time for people to get that repealed, and I hope that they will. But that's just shocking to me. That will remove the last vestige of a Social Security number being in any way a private number, and it will defeat the purposes, really, of asking for a Social Security number, because now it no longer verifies who the person is. Because it is known by lots of people. As I mentioned, Social Security numbers are sold by information brokers, and they're available on the Internet, and it is not very difficult to get somebody's Social Security number.
We're asked for a Social Security number on almost everything. Just this past weekend, you know, I had to punch it in when calling the credit card company. It just says, give us the last four numbers of your Social Security number. Can we say no?
Well, I think the last four numbers might be a fairly good protection. But, yes, of course you can say no in the private sector. There's no law that says you have to give up that information, but there's no law that says they have to do business with you. So you really don't have much protection when private parties like banks and credit card companies and the like ask for your Social Security number. I think people ought to resist that. I think they'll be surprised that insurance companies and a lot of employers will defer and will respect your wishes. There's no need, for instance, to give a Social Security number when you apply for a job, only after you get the job.
But then there's a sense you have something to hide.
Well, maybe, but I think people just have to say, look, I've heard all about this fraudulent use of Social Security numbers and identity theft, and I don't want little kids on the Internet in their bedrooms looking up my Social Security number and then being able to take over my credit account. Oddly enough, the people on the other side of the registration desk can identify more with your concerns about credit card fraud than they can with your concerns about privacy. But I say whatever works, try it.
Radio Shack has been doing something that I was a little surprised by. Going in there to buy batteries, they said, can we have your phone number and can we have your address? And, you know, why do you have to do that when you pay $2 for batteries? And I said no, and they actually put up a little bit of a fight. You know, we need this information. What do they do with that information?
Well, they simply build a database keyed into your telephone number. It's just really another number for their purposes. But then they can market further to you. They know that you purchased batteries or that you purchased earphones or that you purchased a piece of wire. Or a radio, and that helps them. That's valuable information for them to know. and then they simply can either call you on the telephone or write letters to you, provide special incentives and coupons to get you to shop there again. And clearly, if you ordered one kind of stereo equipment, you're going to be interested in some of the components that go with it. So that's very valuable information, and Radio Shack has been doing this for many, many years, and I'm always surprised why people are reluctant to just say no. Many, many shoppers discover that entities ask for a zip code. Now, that's more benign, though I don't think there's any real reason to give it, but it does give merchants a way of knowing exactly where their clientele is coming from.
In your book, Our Vanishing Privacy and What You Can Do About It, and What You Can Do to Protect Yours, you talk about the computer software program called React, which links the phone number that, for example, Radio Shack asks for with the customer's identity. They're not asking you for your name, but then they can find it out.
Well, they already have your name, yeah. First of all, there is software that they can easily use or on the Internet with a phone number they can find out your name and address. But the React system is just a variation on this theme that Radio Shack really, really introduced. And when you provide your phone number at a store that uses this React software, they simply key it into the cash register that will access a computer and call up your record of shopping at that store in the past. And that's valuable information for the clerk to know. They know your vulnerabilities and your interests, and they can market other products to you. So that's what the React is for. Once again, the phone number is being more used as an identifying number in the computer than it is as a means of telephoning you.
We're talking to Robert Smith, who's publisher of the Privacy Journal, which is an independent monthly on privacy in the computer age. Let's talk about our medical records and how much privacy we have around them.
Well, my experience is that this is the biggest gap between Americans' expectations of privacy and what the reality is. Most people assume that their medical records are protected and that there is a law that provides for the confidentiality of medical information. That's just not true. There are laws in about six or seven states, and that's it, that there is a ethical standard in the profession that we know about that calls for confidentiality, but that's really very little protection. The doctors are always giving up that information to insurance companies and to employers. What used to be a one-on-one relationship between you and your doctor now is a three-way relationship involving the insurance company that's paying the bills, and it's just automatic that that information now goes to the insurance company. And because your insurance is administered where you work, then your personnel office quite often gets a copy of all your claims and does know where you were treated. So it's no longer a private matter. It is shocking to me that in 1997, we have stronger privacy protection in this nation for video rental records than we do for medical records.
Oh, my God. What do you mean?
Well, there is a law in the books that Congress passed very, very quickly that provide some measure of confidentiality for the videos that you rent in a store. But
was this passed after the Clarence Thomas nomination hearings for the Supreme Court?
You're probably thinking of Robert Bork. When his nomination for the Supreme Court was before the Senate, a newspaper in Washington got his video records to find out what he had rented. They also got them on Oliver North when he was before the Congress. Well, it just shows where Congress's priorities are. I mean, in very quick order, they passed some confidentiality protections with regard to video rental records. But over the last 20 years, they have not been able to pass meaningful legislation that protects medical records. We're extremely vulnerable on that. Not only do about six states really provide for confidentiality of medical information, but only about half the states give people a right by law to have access to their own patient record. Now, that's something that seems to me very elementary and very necessary and probably very helpful in treatment as well. But only half the states provide that as a matter of law. And a lot of patients have been extremely frustrated when they can't even get access to their own medical record. Here,
I mean, it's unbelievable. We can't get access to our own medical records, but everyone else can.
Well, that's exactly it. Everybody else can. And we're asked to sign an authorization that gives up our medical file to the insurance company or to our employer or to lots of other people. And here we don't even know what we're authorizing because in many states you're not able to see it yourself.
On the issue of medical records, when it comes to medical records being given beyond the employer or the insurance company. Do doctors sell lists to drug companies?
Well, I'm afraid they do, yeah. A lot of them do. They think of it as more benign than that. There are lots of forms to fill out in many doctors' offices, including gynecologists, where people indicate that they'd like to know about more products and services involving their particular condition. A lot of hospitals now are desperate to market their services and to compete with the hospital down the street. And in doing that, they sponsor clinics in shopping malls and elsewhere to test your blood and the like. And they take the registration forms that people file and they build mailing lists based on that. And if your test turns out to be positive for a certain diagnosis, high blood pressure or obesity or something, then hospitals start to market using that information. And doctors also have made deals with prescription companies whereby the prescription company will install a computer system for keeping track of prescriptions, but in exchange for that, the doctors give up the prescription doses that they are prescribing to their patients. Many of these systems are cumulative and they don't have individual identifiers about patients, but there are others that do identify dosages that are prescribed to patients. And the important thing to remember is that there's no law against a doctor giving that information out to a drug marketing company.
Robert Smith, what does the Quaker Oats Company want to know your views on gun control for?
Well, that's a good question. I put that in my book, Our Vanishing Privacy, because I wondered too. In fact, it is kind of a test question to determine whether the family is of a particular, not necessarily a political persuasion, but whether they're anti-authoritarian or not, or whether they go along with the mainstream of America or not. The Quaker Oats Company, and having a promotion among children, asked for some of these political views within their family simply as a measure of trying to find out whether the family was mainstream or not. And it's kind of shocking that in order to participate in some minor kiddie promotion, you have to give up a lot of personal information about the family. Another more modern example is some of the cereal companies that have websites for kiddies ask for daddy's income and what language is spoken at home and what kind of a job does daddy have and does he smoke and all those sorts of things, all for the purpose of getting a measure of the family's lifestyle and once again trying to target them for further marketing.
Why doesn't the phone company tell us about call trace, which is a form of caller ID that doesn't let telemarketers shatter your privacy?
I don't know. I mean, it's a very good service. It's a much more effective and less dangerous service than caller ID. Call trace simply allows you, you don't even have to subscribe to it. You get a call that you view as either harassing or violent or even disagreeable. You simply dial 3 digits on your phone and it will automatically be traced. You won't know who the caller is, but that information will be stored by the phone company. And if you get more than 2 of those calls and they're traced to the same phone number, then the phone company will cooperate with the police to try to track down who exactly it is who made the call. And it's a service that I think is very effective in cutting down on harassing phone calls. Caller ID, I think, has a lot of flaws because it simply tells you the number from which somebody's calling. It doesn't provide their identity. And there is now blocking service available for people who wish not to have their number identified. And caller ID doesn't work outside of your area code. So I think caller ID has real limitations in tracking down harassing calls. But call trace is very effective, and the phone companies don't tell us about it.
Robert Smith, what is a personal barcode?
Well, personal barcode is just like the barcode on a box of Wheaties, only identifies an individual. Now more and more pets have barcodes that identify them uniquely. Sure, just on their collar. By putting a barcode on there, you're simply putting a lot of numbers that identify the pet, and with those numbers, then you can link it to a dossier that's stored in a computer, and that will give further information about the pet. Not only do they have ID codes, but many pets in shelters throughout America now have a microchip that's implanted underneath their skin, and it can be read by a device so that it will identify the pet.
Oh,
Now, I think it's only a short way away from using that with human beings. I really believe that in 5 years there'll be advocates for microchips for individuals.
Wow, like instead of the ankle bracelet?
Yeah, and think about it. Like so many of these pernicious invasions of privacy, it will start with the very best of reasons, and we'll all be persuaded that these are very benign reasons.
Whoa.
Think of Alzheimer's patients or young children who might be vulnerable to kidnapping. I think a lot of people would agree to human skin implants that would identify the individual.
We have 20 seconds. What is the best way to protect your privacy?
Have two of everything. Two phone numbers, two wastebaskets, two jobs, two doctors, two internet access providers, all the rest. That's the best advice.
Because?
Keep them wary. One is private, one is not known to other people except your very close friends, and the other one's your public persona. I think you really have to create a public persona and a very private persona. Europeans have known that for years, and I think we Americans have to learn that.
Well, Robert Ellis Smith, I want to thank you for joining us. We are going to come back to you in the future because this is very important stuff. Robert Ellis Smith, publisher of the Privacy Journal. His book is called Our Vanishing Privacy and What You Can Do to Protect Yours. It's published by Lupanix Unlimited. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, heard from Hawaii to Maine and from Washington to Florida. We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations routinely speaks of freedom and democracy, yet the world body is a profoundly undemocratic organization. The Big Five, China, Britain, France, Russia, and the United States, dominate war and peace issues in the Security Council. And at UN organizations like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, it's $1, one vote. But in the wake of the Cold War, many activists and non-governmental organizations, known as NGOs, have launched new efforts to democratize the United Nations. Here to talk about these efforts are two guests, Jim Paul of Global Policy Forum, which is a research and advocacy organization that focuses on the United Nations and international issues, and Bill Pace is with us of the World Federalist Movement, a group founded after World War II by such luminaries as Albert Einstein and Bertrand Russell, which seeks to strengthen democratic federal institutions at the global level. Well, why don't we start with Jim Paul of the Global Policy Forum. Can you lay out for us what your proposals are to democratize the United Nations?
First of all, it's important to pose the question, why do we want to democratize the United Nations? An awful lot of people on the left say the UN is hopeless, globalization is really a process that's being pushed along by international capital. It's not in the interest of the people. The thing to do is to reinforce local power and local initiatives, to go back to local community and so on. Therefore, that whole project, the whole project of looking at the UN reinforcing global institutions, is a bad idea. We say that's mistaken. I think the emphasis on local communities is often misplaced. Local communities are idealized in a whole lot of different ways. It doesn't square with what communities were and are. And the possibilities of globalization fits in with a historic commitment of the left to internationalism. It's rather sad that that commitment has been lost recently. So our project of democratization of the UN takes an institution that is the most democratic and open institution of all the global institutions, and but recognizes that it's still a huge distance away from being the kind of place that we want it to be, and tries to push it in the direction of a greater openness to democracy, to people's movements, and so on, in order to address the enormously complex and enormously difficult and problems that are facing the world today, like environment and increasing differences in income and so on.
Bill Pace, how do you do that? How do you democratize the United Nations?
Well, our organization has a number of programs, from strengthening the rule of law and the protection of human rights, fundamental reform of the decision-making processes of the institutions of the United Nations.
Let's take that one.
Reform of the institutions of the United Nations. Well, for example, one of our main projects right now is extending the rights of citizen groups to the work of the General Assembly and other areas of the United Nations. The G77, which is a group of about 130 developing countries, brought this issue forward last year in one of the principal organs of the UN, the Economic and Social Council, where NGO or non-governmental organization rights have been contained over the years inside this one body. And last summer they made a proposal that was adopted by consensus that the General Assembly begin exploring extending consultative arrangements throughout the UN for non-governmental groups. So it will look at what are the arrangements now for us to attend, participate in meetings, consult, not be voters or negotiators, not claim that we represent any more than what we represent, the expertise and the membership of our organizations, but to be able to participate more completely in the UN in its deliberations. We've just gone through a cycle of extraordinary world conferences, and they've never been, as the summits have been the largest summits in history, on the largest range of issues, and involving the greatest amount of citizen participation. And I might say one of the major groups that has emerged, and probably the most powerful change agent in international decision-making, is the Women's Caucus that has emerged. And a lot of the practices and processes from the Women's Caucus are the kinds of mechanisms we would now like to bring into the implementation, the regular work of the UN and its main committees.
Now, I think when people hear the United Nations, they may have different attitudes toward it, but I bet one thing they think about is bureaucracy. I don't understand how you'd bring them into the General Assembly, in what way that you can't do now. You can consult with any of the governments. You can talk to them about your views. What specifically would you do differently?
Well, right now, many of this last 2 or 3 weeks, you've had a preparatory meeting for the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaties Review Conference, and NGOs have basically been locked out of the meetings. They are given kind of the token ability to come in one day and make statements, but when you don't hear what the government's positions are in the policy-making debates, then it's hard for you to criticize and comment intelligently on those. So one of the issues is to get into it. I want to comment, though. I mean, the hallucination about the bureaucracy of the United Nations is this disinformation campaign that's been going on in the U.S. for a number of years. I'm from the state of Wyoming. The two smallest budgets of states in the United States are, I think, South Dakota's, which is about $1.7 billion, Wyoming's, which is $1.9 billion. The Secretary General's budget is $1.1 billion. I mean, if you add up all of the institutions of the United Nations, including the World Health Organizations, the International Aviation, International Postal Service, all of them, the World Bank, et cetera, it's smaller than Disney World. So this mythology, I mean, yes, of course there's bureaucracy. You have 185 bosses because you have one nation, one vote, consensus-based decision-making over there. But it's amazing how much is actually done with fewer employees than most major transnational organizations located here in New York.
I noticed in the Times today that
there were
about 6,500 employees of the U.S. government that were devoted to selling arms internationally, and that the budget for selling arms was, I think, something like $5.5 billion. Now, that compares with the $312 or $300 million that the U.S. is supposed to pay as its regular dues to the U.N. and refuses to pay, and that gives you some idea of the where the priorities seem to be in Washington.
Yeah, and that money, $5.5 billion, that's to promote private corporations selling weapons like Lockheed
that's
Martin
right.
and McDonnell
that's
Douglas.
Right. A market that amounts to $15 or $20 billion a year. So the government's subsidy of that is very high.
Speaking of corporations, what is their view towards the United Nations? Do they see it as just a an obstacle to what they want to accomplish? Do they lobby Congress against the UN and funding of the UN?
Well, my own feeling is that stereotypes are too generalized. They're different businesses that have different motivations. I would say, though, in the same way that progressive and democratic governments want to see a level playing field with high standards, whether it's dealing with global environmental protection or copyright protection or what have you, that there are many businesses that would like to see the rule of law replace the rule of chaos and force and dictatorships where your investments can be nationalized or seized by some junta, et cetera. On the other hand, there are all sorts of transnational corporate businesses that take full advantage of the chaos in the world, whether it's the way they launder money or the way they exchange currency and undermine governments and national currencies, et cetera. So it's a mixed bag. I would say that for my group, we would welcome a greater role, formal role of business and industry in international negotiations for one reason alone, and that is, if no others, and that is that if you don't have them at the negotiating table, they use the governments to do their negotiating for them. If they're at the table, we believe then that governments will become a more honest broker between citizens and business.
If I could speak to the issue of TNCs in this process.
Transnational corporations.
It seems to me that in this particular period, unlike 20 and 30 years ago when there was a kind of consensus in the very largest corporations that there had to be a fairly substantial role for the state, both in the domestic economy and a certain regulatory apparatus internationally through institutions like the World Bank and the IMF and so on, that in the last 20 years or so, the shift has moved, there's been a shift away from this view towards support for what we often call neoliberalism, that is to say, an economy that is deregulated very sharply. And you can see that particularly clearly domestically. And if you look at the Wall Street Journal and you look at the major organs of business, you see very sharp criticisms of the UN. Some of them are the type of propaganda that Bill has been talking about that have no bearing on reality. But others are very specific policy criticisms that have to do with the need to eliminate regulation in certain areas. For instance, the need to eliminate a regulation on activities having to do with the environment. There's a lot of corporate concern that there will be additional regulation of the environment that's going to cost them money. And, of course, we feel that, if anything, the globe is in very serious danger, not only human species but others at this time, and that we very desperately need to have additional regulation. So that's where we differ.
We're talking to Jim Paul, who's head of the Global Policy Forum, and Bill Pace of the World Federalist Movement. Let's just stop for a minute. If each of you could tell me about your organization, World Federalist Movement, started after World War II?
We were started at the end of World War II. Founders like Einstein and Russell and Thomas Mann and others who realized that the charter that was adopted by the victors of World War II would not be capable of the preamble's goals, which was to rid the world of the scourge of war, that while the charter envisioned the capacity of the United Nations to be able to enforce international peace and security and to deal with the eradication of poverty and discrimination, in fact, the victors of the war of World War II in the United States, we were not willing to extend rights to all our citizens, obviously. That took another generation. France and Britain and Belgium, everybody tried to reoccupy their empires. Anyway, the World Federalists were a group that wanted to strengthen the democratic federal institutions at the global level and make decisions in the same way that the democracies had evolved in the last 200 years and apply that to global decision-making and problem-solving.
Are you happy about the World Bank and the IMF?
Well, I don't think any institution where it's $1, one vote, and the organizations that run it are running it primarily for their own benefit is one that is based upon the principles that my organization seeks to infuse. So, no, we're not happy with the World Bank. But do I prefer to have a World Bank with a global environmental facility that is putting some regulations now on how money is invested in the least developing countries versus this private capital, which has just completely eclipsed public investment? Yes, and so if we can strengthen, say, the General Assembly and make it a more accountable, effective body, more a democratically responsive body for global policy making, then it can start giving the kind of global policy direction to the World Trade Organizations, the international financial institutions, and other bodies. But if we continue this path that the U.S. and many, as Jim said, leftists and rightists and all sorts are doing, which is just to naively and strategically try and destroy the U.N. and the General Assembly, then the institutions that will fill the vacuum will be the WTOs and the G7s.
Jim Paul, your organization, the Global Policy Forum.
Global Policy Forum was founded in 1993. One of the people who inspired its foundation was Erskine Childers, who later, more recently, was the Secretary General of the World Federation of UNAs.
UN agencies.
United Nations Associations. And a Global Policy Forum has been working on three major areas. First of all, the financial crisis of the UN. And we built a global movement of protest against the UN's financial crisis. And we held a vigil in October 23rd, the eve of UN Day last year. And there were vigils in, I think it was the 32 cities all over the world. In addition to that, we're working on the Security Council, the reform of the Security Council, dialogue between NGO groups and the Council, and again, pushing for a kind of a democratization of that institution. And finally, we're interested in the global social and economic decision-making process, and again, the World Bank and the WTO, and how these institutions can be made more accountable.
On the issue of the Security Council, how do you think it should be changed?
Well, the Security Council is an extraordinarily undemocratic institution. It functions almost entirely behind closed doors. So it used to be that the Security Council met in public session most of the time. Now it mostly meets in private consultation, so there's no minutes, there's no sense of what's going on there. Of course, it's also dominated by five so-called permanent members. We prefer to call them non-elected members, by contrast with the 10 elected members that have only 2 years on the council and then rotate off. This was a system that was set up based on the victors of World War II. It's a kind of throwback to some extent to 19th century international conferences and so on, and it really doesn't take seriously the idea of international cooperation.
Jim Paul of the Global Policy Forum and Bill Pace, I want to thank you very much for joining us. The Global Policy Forum, a research and advocacy organization that focuses on the United Nations, and Bill Pace, head of the World Federalist Movement, founded after World War II by people like Albert Einstein and Bertrand Russell. The World Federalist Movement seeks to strengthen democratic federal institutions at the global level. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call to order a cassette, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our engineer and assistant producer. Andy York, our Washington engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!